Let's kind of conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome to the podcast Penny Von Eschen. Penny is a professor of history and the William R. Keenan Jr. Professor in American Studies at the University of Virginia in the Department of History, and the author of Paradoxes of Nostalgia, Cold War Triumphalism and Global Disorder since 1989. Penny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So here's just with the first question. What inspired you to write this book? You're a historian. You focus most on your work, not on the more recent past. But what about the world today inspired you to write about nostalgia in the Cold War?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So the idea of the book started to congeal in the early 2000s as the U.S. was at war with Afghanistan and then went into Iraq. And at the moment, I was finishing an earlier book, Satchmo Blows Up the World. And I remember in 2003 finishing that and writing about Duke Ellington in Baghdad at a moment when the U.S. had actually intervened and helped to overthrow a government, and then they couldn't control it, so they didn't quite get their way. And just the kind of the utter tragedy of this repetition, the lack of knowledge of the history, but just overwhelmingly, in that moment of war, I was just profoundly disturbed by, I mean, I was an historian. I'd done two books on the Cold War, intersecting with colonialism and anti-colonialism. I was so disturbed at the obvious distortions of history, both the distortions that were used as a justification for weapons of mass destruction and going into Iraq, but a very systematic distortion of the U.S. past in this entire region and globally. And along with those distortions, I kept hearing a weird mix of what I see as triumphalism and nostalgia. I miss the Cold War. It was so much safer and so much stable. We knew who our enemies were, which is profoundly obscene as millions and millions of people died in conflicts in Latin America, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, throughout Asia. And along with this kind of distorted triumphalism, I was also, this distorted nostalgia, I was also hearing a triumph, you know, this as a justification for newly going to war. I was hearing a triumphalism, you know, we won the Cold War because of our military strength, because we didn't hold back, because we were, you know, willing to pull out our military might. Therefore, we must do this again. So it was those two combination in a very disturbing moment. And then a slightly independent, but I don't think altogether unrelated phenomenon was that this is a moment when there was kind of a burst of what people called nostalgia in East Germany, a lot of expressions of nostalgia for the values and stability of the Cold War era in the Eastern Bloc. And the American or the U.S. commentary was constantly just saying, those people are out of their minds. How could they possibly miss that horrible, horrible era? What, there's nothing to miss about it. So there was a disdain for Eastern Bloc expressions of nostalgia. And I talk about that nostalgia. It wasn't nostalgia for authoritarian regimes, but it was almost nostalgia for political hope, nostalgia for the reform movements, for nostalgia for a time when not everything was defined by the market and about money. So you're getting this U.S. disdain for Eastern Bloc forms of nostalgia while seemingly completely missing the fact that Americans were awash in their own nostalgia. So I thought, this is all very weird, and this really needs to be investigated. And of course, this is a moment with a lot of calls to global history. So what would it really mean to really push in many different ways on kind of U.S. from the outside in, the American impact, like what does it look like when American triumphalism travels into former Soviet spaces? So let's, you know, find I call it globally framed. It's not about the whole world or everything, but let's really look at these critical sites where this kind of triumphalism, intervention, and nostalgias are operating. And really, what is that about? How did that happen? Let's investigate that.
So obviously, nostalgia is a key conceptual category. How do you use nostalgia, and what do you mean by it? What is the affective dimension of it?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways that nostalgia operates, and I'll quickly get to some of the dominant affective dimensions. But I think it is important, and I make a distinction between, I think, two very important senses and maybe two dominant senses of nostalgia. And one is what I think can be a critical nostalgia. And I see this as perhaps a more, you know, affective form. Well, they're all affective, but the critical nostalgia, which I think came both, there's expressions in both the West and the East, but the critical nostalgia could be a real look at the world changed very quickly, kind of went wrong. And you see this in expressions of, you might see in the Eastern Bloc, for example, but also in the West. You know, I used to have a job. I used to have healthcare. And people often use the language, life was more continuous. Not everything was about money. We didn't have a lot. We were, you know, we didn't like the state, but my relationships were richer. Intimacy was just a lot more, you know, just much richer. So there's a way to say, what changed? And that's a good historical question that leads to critical inquiry. What changed? What went wrong? And let's look at what had been lost that was of value. And I think you could really see a critical nostalgia also in going back to the period of change. So some of the very important reformers of that period, and this is not all of them, but Vaclav Havel, Mikhail Gorbachev, Nelson Mandela, sort of the anti-apartheid movement, all of these movements had critiques of authoritarian governments in both its communist bloc forms as well as its capitalist imperialist forms. And they all they all said, there's something's gone very wrong in this Cold War period. There's been horrible military destruction. There's been horrible environmental waste. And this is both militarism and a race to consumption. So we really need to say, you know, we must examine that and we must not repeat that. So it's not a nostalgia that everything was great, but part of the critical nostalgia was a nostalgia for those very serious critical reform movements. And again, I say nostalgia is always dangerous because even a critical nostalgia can morph into something which reifies an invented and simplified past. And part of what I do is trace various moments when critical nostalgias morph into a nostalgia that claims, like the form in the United States, you know, that there was a, you know, we were absolutely right. We had all the answers. This was, you know, glorifies a past, overlooks all of its flaws. And one of my chapters looks at patterns of claims, especially in the Eastern Bloc, but putting that in conversation with the West. And I think one of the things that I saw over the course of the 2000s is multiple sites and museums, Hungary, Poland, Lithuania, where I think there were, and I think Russia is a really important example of this, where there were genuine calls, there were genuine open queries into, let's examine this past with all of its warts, all of its, you know, let's not cover up the horror, but let's, you know, so we had, you know, there was political repression, we had great ballet and hockey, let's look at all elements of this. And then those, and I think of one example in a political museum in St. Petersburg in 2008, but this could be echoed in really interesting parks in Budapest, outside of Vilnius. You get real invitations to really examine this past critically and really.
These are the famous monument parks, right? We're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But then in conjunction with sort of a global turn to more authoritarian governments in some of these very places, you then see that critical inquiry really taken out and you get very strong stories of victimization. So Poland's a strong example, but Russia is so ironic because I had a really kind of an accidental chance to go back to this museum in St. Petersburg and to Moscow in 2017. And by this point, Putin is already constructing the Russians as the biggest victims of the Soviets, of everybody. So you get very, very strong claims of victimization. And in all these cases, Poland, Hungary, Russia, they're hearkening back to this kind of mythic past of a pure ethnically, religiously defined country that is now in this story under threat by whether it's Western values. And I think a lot of the conditions for that turn came from the enormous destabilization that comes from the U.S. wars in the Middle East, and then Iraq spilling into Syria, spilling into genuine refugee crises, which right-wing politicians took up as extremely xenophobic claims against outsiders, and really, you know, helped their claims for, again, this very pure mythic past.
No, that's really helpful. Let's now return for a second to the book and the first substantive chapter. Great introduction, but right after the intro is a chapter titled "The Ends of History," where you examine these disagreements between the Americans and these three foreign visitors who came to the United States in order to define this post-Cold War geopolitical order. Could you first talk about the end of history as a concept and why you titled your chapter "The Ends of History," and how these three figures and their, you know, the various debates, at least implicitly with George H.W. Bush, informed the post-Cold War, you know, set the stage as it were for the post-Cold War world?
Yeah, thank you for that. So just to start in a really simple way, I kind of play with the ends of history because I think unlike maybe some more casual observers of George H.W. Bush, I actually see Bush as an incredibly calculated, if not sort of masterful craftsperson of the uses and abuses of history, keenly aware of the purposes to which history is put as he moves through various political stages. So it's very much about sort of the uses of history. And so the end of history is obviously the big buzzword in this period, with people picking up Fukuyama's notion of the end of history, and this notion that with the collapse of an Eastern Bloc, or the weakening first of an Eastern Bloc, that all big ideological questions in history have been solved, and that the only path, everyone's agreed, the claim goes, that the only path to a modern future is in a liberal capitalist democracy society. And I would, you know, I don't think we can emphasize strongly enough that, you know, despite Fukuyama's later evolution and latter day claims, in this moment, capitalism was just completely conflated with democracy. So those things like really, really came together. And I think the really important thing for me is that because of the power of neoliberalism, how much this deregulated new mode of economy really swept through the globe, we can look back as if it's inevitable. But in fact, there was so much more on the table. And that notion completely belies and violates the dominant vision of the reformers. So I look at the visits of Havel and Mandela, and also to a lesser extent, I look at Poland to a lesser extent, and also certainly look at Gorbachev and his visions and how those collided with Bush's. But what's interesting about this period and this rapid moment of contingency, Havel is imprisoned, still in prison at the end of 98, gets out of prison, becomes president. He comes to the States in February. Mandela, and this very right before Havel comes, Mandela's been released from prison. Mandela then visits in June of 1990. So you have this rapid succession of these, you know, of these reforming heroes. And we can come back to Gorbachev's very triumphant visit just before, you know, he's been in the United States. He's still a real darling of Americans. And the vision is that's projected by Gorbachev and Havel and Mandela, and I'll talk more about Havel and Mandela here, is very strongly that of a radical need for demilitarization, that the military excess and buildup of the Cold War has caused great destruction, enormous environmental damage, great economic inequality, and that there's also a real critique of consumption, you know, that we have to rethink the good life. This race consumption has produced mounds of garbage. It's destroyed the environment. So environmentalism goes hand in hand with this new, with an emphasis on demilitarization. And there's also both, especially Mandela, but also Havel, are putting a redistributive agenda on the table, and especially Mandela. So yes, they want, in the words of like Havel and the Eastern reformers, they want socialism with a human face. They do not want unregulated, untrammeled capitalism. They're not jumping onto the capitalist bandwagon. And they recognize the problems in central planning. They absolutely want, they absolutely want a sort of mixed market reforms in the places where appropriate. But those market reforms were never intended to go into basic human rights, healthcare, education. So this was, this was all supposed to be preserved and strengthened. So Havel's visit is very, is just very interesting, because Havel is saying that these Cold War institutions are irrelevant. We need to abolish the Warsaw Pact, abolish NATO. And this infuriates Bush. It sends all sorts of Americans into kind of an enormous state of alarm. And so there's a whole little kind of like dances, dances around that, where, but it makes very, very clear how much this demilitarization is on the table. When Mandela then visits, there's some real deep confrontations with Bush over, both over, the big issues are that Mandela refuses to denounce the military arm of the ANC and denounce any use of political violence. And so Bush is really trying to dictate the terms. So like, you absolutely must denounce any form of violence. And Mandela says, look, if we had any political rights, if we had any political civil rights, of course we would never, ever, ever use violence. But we absolutely have no political civil rights. So we absolutely have a right to self-defense. And the other big issue is, and then the other issue is Mandela and the ANC's insistence on economic justice and redistribution. And this also greatly alarms Bush and many other people. And like Thatcher in Britain, for example, is also, her advisors are telling Mandela, do not use the word nationalization in front of Thatcher. You can't speak in these terms. And over time, Mandela and the ANC, maybe tragically become convinced that if they don't give up certain demands for nationalization in some areas and redistribution, they will not get any investment. And this continues to be a very, very important bone of contention between Mandela and Bush. And then another issue, which is very wrapped up in this, is it's wrapped up in demilitarization, is that it's really about the United Nations and the role of sort of a non-aligned third world bloc in the United Nations. And Bush, along with a lot of other Americans, are appalled that Mandela will not denounce Castro, Yasser Arafat. And Mandela says, look, these people were our allies. They supported us in this horrible period of apartheid when nobody else did. And we're not going to denounce them. But I think this is really important, because after Iraq and Saddam Hussein invade Kuwait, and as Bush is pushing globally for a military alliance that will back the United States in going to war in Iraq rather than getting a negotiated settlement or a timed settlement. Initially, the dominant view globally and certainly at the UN was that we must have a negotiated settlement that would involve broader peace in the Middle East and issues of Palestinian rights. Saddam Hussein was happy to talk about a timeline for settlement and withdrawal, but for various reasons, Bush would not have this. And I think he really saw this as a moment when the U.S. could declare its unilateral power over both this broader third world bloc and Gorbachev, who supported negotiated settlements, as well as, I think, you know, Bush had a very strong antipathy toward this third world bloc in the United Nations and really kind of wanted to assert U.S. dominance and put that to rest. So I think all of those things played out. And I mean,
Just a quick question. We historians, you know, you could tell this very complex story, but in the end, tell me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing is like Bush wanted domination and that was that. You know, like there was all these other things and there were all these other, you know, flows and people moving and debates, but in the end, Bush wanted to fucking dominate the world. And he was going to bulldoze anyone who disagreed with that. Is that wrong?
Well, in a sense, I think it's not wrong. I mean, because Bush told his advisors, you know, there are no longer two superpowers in the world. There's only one. You know,
yeah, we're going to dominate it, and this is the dream. And who cares what Mandela says?
Well, absolutely, and I think, and he was going to kind of dominate anyone who's not in line. Now, and it's not really a caution against that. Bush really moved through what I see as a very clever carrot and stick diplomacy. So he's going to hovel and saying, you know, I know, like, I think Bush is probably thinking something like, I know human rights are really important to hovel. So I'm going to emphasize the abuses of human rights by Iraq. Here, I'm going to threaten somebody with, you know, impoverishment or intervention if they don't kind of go along with me. But I think he was very, very aggressive in kind of getting his way in the vision as a U.S. as a unipolar power. And I also, this is obviously deeply tied up with oil. So going into Iraq, being able to, in his mind, maintain access to oil. And, you know, from his perspective, they were not about to abandon this. You know, the U.S. is so ensconced in a deep carbon, oil, military, industrial complex. And of course, the military, in some sense, they cut back in some ways. It got, you know, you could talk about it as meaner and leaner, but they did not demilitarize in any, meaningful sense.
Well, that's all because of the revolution in military affairs too, right? It's coincident. Right. So they're like, they think we'll do the same exact thing for slightly cheaper. Turns out they'll have that and they'll just balloon the budget. Because to me, like, I know, like, after the postmodern turn, we're all skeptical of master narratives, but this just seems like you could fit this pretty easily into the master narrative of since 1941, the US wanted to dominate the world. And it basically every choice, except for maybe a few years in the 1970s, at every decision point, they just made the decision to expand the domination. And I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at, you know, trying to look at this holistically from 2023.
Yeah, I think both following Reagan but I think George H.W. Bush, again, a background in the CIA, a background in oil, but I think Bush was absolutely resolute that the United States had the right and should be the only person setting the terms of the globe, and that anybody who really disagreed had to be gotten out of the way, whether that was turning on former clients in Panama or Saddam Hussein, who'd been an ally for so long, but just absolutely resolute. And I think now when I say, you know, I do think it's important to emphasize divisions within the U.S. government. And So I try to pay
for
attention.
Sure, for sure. Yeah, the state isn't holistic. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a very strong view that is, you know, very intolerant of, it is basically intolerant of the UN too, because it's intolerant of global institutions, because the United States, you know, these global institutions should not be dictating to the United States in the view of somebody like George H.W. Bush. And the way you see this very concretely is, even in the 80s, which is such an interesting contested politics, when there's, you know, when Reagan is going, you know, greatly expanding the military, going into Central America, South Africa, just really ratcheting up militarism in so many different places, Afghanistan, I mean, we could just go on. But it's, you know, you've got very strong critics in Congress. This is very hotly debated. And because Congress... But one thing that happens under Reagan is basically the U.S. stops paying their dues to the U.N. So there's all sorts of ways to undermine these organizations. And
we leave UNESCO every, 7 to 10 years? It's like the thing that U.S. presidents love doing.
No, absolutely. So it was very outrageous that Trump to leave the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreements, but there's a real precedent. There's a real precedent to that. And in fact, you know, in the 90s, when, you know, again, there's a tug of war between more global, you know, more globally cooperative and international forces. But once again, after Newt Gingrich and Contract for America, once the Republicans took Congress, they were once again not paying UN dues. And they were overtly undermining diplomatic agreements that other, you know, parts of the U.S. government were really working on not going to war with Korea. It's this agreed frame under the Clinton framework, but that was getting subtly undermined by people simply refusing to pay if Congress controls the purse strings. So I think that's a very important part of the story. And it also shows that there are alternatives, just like there was a real alternate vision on the table at the end of the Cold War that involved demilitarization, addressing climate, environmental disaster, that was on the table then. And there were, you know, there were disagreements and tussles, but yes, there was a very, very strong vision of, you know, that the U.S. is the only power and the world's going to be kind of set under its, you know, dictating to its, its directives.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at AmericanPrestigePod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Penny, let's get into chapter two, which really talks about the 90s. And I love this because the 90s were like my formative political years. And it's
Derek's
such an interesting
90s
time. This is the unipolar moment. It's the time when Washington decides that instead of dismantling this military machine we've built over the Cold War, what if we used it for good things? What if we did nice stuff with it? And so you talk about Somalia, you talk about the decision not to intervene in Rwanda, you talk about Yugoslavia and the breakup of Yugoslavia. But it's also the era of the clash of civilizations rhetoric, which is, you know, sort of Samuel Huntington's response to Fukuyama, the idea that we're not fighting over ideology anymore, okay, but we're going to go back to an earlier time sort of fighting over these kind of fundamental civilizational values, cultural, religious, etc. But as you note, that phrase, which had been kicking around for a long time, but Huntington gets it from Bernard Lewis, who again kind of puts me in flashbacks of grad school. But he gets it from Bernard Lewis specifically from an article called The Roots of Muslim Rage. So this is like specifically referring to this supposed incompatibility of Western liberalism and Islam, essentially. Can you talk about these two strains of thinking and how they kind of juxtapose with one another or interact to produce what we see in the U.S. in the 90s?
Absolutely. And by too strange, you mean kind of end of ideology and the clash of civilizations.
Right. And then sort of this impulse to do humanitarian intervention, which I always think is such a weird concept, but was really dominant in this period.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me start with the clash of civilizations. So yeah, you're right. This is a reinvention of very old civilization ideas, but it's just remarkable how fast that's kind of pulled out when people in many different registers are saying, oh, what do we do without the communist enemy? We need an enemy. Like, and how quickly people move to this idea of this threat of, you know, the non-civilized. And interestingly, I mean, I'm interested in how many different registers that's working in, because the very week that Lewis's article, The Roots of Muslim Rage, come out in The Atlantic, George H.W. Bush gives his kind of strategic vision speech, in which he talks about the threat in Iraq of the rule of the jungle overwhelming the rule of law. And this is a clash between the rule of law and the rule of the jungle. And of course, Reagan's used this civilizationist language too, and they're pulling this back in. And I mean, we should just stop and say how ridiculous and ahistorical Bernard Lewis is. And so he's making a claim. He overtly makes a claim.
I trust any Princeton professor until the day I die. I don't know, Penny.
But I mean, it's completely historical, because he's overtly saying that there's something so irrational here. It cannot possibly be explained by any political or policy circumstance. And he basically then, he kind of basically equates, all of Islam through all of history gets reduced to this really ridiculous reified idea. But again, this starts to operate in many different registers, because you're getting this idea of this fear of Islam and an idea of a clash of civilization from academics, from popularizing pundits like Robert Kaplan, from popular writers like Tom Clancy, who's been this big Cold War novelist, and his stuff's getting adapted into films. And all of a sudden, his new work is imagining this unified Islamic state, bizarrely India, China, and the Middle East, attacking the United States, killing the president. So you're getting this kind of hysteria. But it's, and in what was considered more kind of sober foreign policy circles, although, you know, it's a very irrational idea, I think, that's deeply linked to the clash of civilizations. You have the evolution of this rogue state idea, which was around in the Reagan era, but really gets articulated by Anthony Lake in the Clinton administration. So this idea of the rogue misbehaving state who's outside of the family of nations and outside of civilization. And with these rogue states, they're utterly irrational. They cannot be trusted. They have no legitimate grievances. It's totally irrational. The only thing to do is to undermine them through sanctions, through discipline, or through intervention. I don't know if you want to follow up on this, or I could say more about the way this plays out in these early conflicts.
Let's talk about the early conflicts, and particularly, like, I've always been interested with, you know, the example of, let's say, Somalia, and what was really a failed intervention. I mean, the U.S. had to leave kind of in disgrace, versus Rwanda and the decision not to intervene, and watching what happened there. That seemed much more, impactful on the thinking of folks in DC than the example of Somalia. You could have taken a lesson away from that the US just isn't equipped to do this kind of thing. But it felt like not intervening in Rwanda was really, they took the lesson away from that the U.S. has to intervene in situations like this. It must, you know, we must, we're the indispensable nation, you know, we have to be involved.
Right, that there was a humanitarian failure in that sense to intervene, and that was tied up with Bosnia. And so just to really, you know, quickly note, what critics at the time noted about Somalia is that, like, so why did the U.S. intervene? And, you know, obviously, this is a more, it's a more complex story of a former Soviet clientele state that then kind of turns to the U.S., but the U.S. had invested, there was a lot of oil investment in Somalia. So what the really good investigative journalists and critics at the moment would have pointed this out. And I think that's absolutely true. But let's, but in the case of Rwanda and some, and Bosnia, and in this case, I think one of the things I think we should emphasize about, you know, I felt like it was very important to look at these broad patterns because I was seeing the same logic in the justifications for intervention and not, intervening or not intervening. So I thought that was really important, but it's also very dependent, you know, rightly so. And I think as people do globally framed histories in just kind of enmeshing myself in literatures of people that have written deeply on Rwanda and Bosnia. So in the case of Rwanda, Mahmoud Mabdani, along with others, I think has been really important. And I think, so there's two aspects to this argument. And I think the first is, I think there's this massive evidence that and these conflicts like move across the Bush and Clinton administration, but we could focus on Clinton. For, you know, in the administration, partly having read Robert Kaplan and listening to other advisors, Clinton and many other people became sadly convinced that, again, it's a clash of civilizations idea that, you know, these people have been fighting with each other for thousands of years. These are ancient hatreds. These are irrational. There's no political explanation for them. There's no contemporary, there's no policy or political explanation. They're just irrational hatreds. Therefore, we just can't do anything about it. We're going to wring our hands. It's very unfortunate. Now, what historians like Woodward in Bosnia and Mahmoud Mandani have shown is that there's multiple political causes and political explanations. And it's not all about the United States or the West, but in fact, the actions of the West are directly implicated. You cannot understand the breakdown in either Rwanda or Bosnia without understanding policy, you know, going back, you know, in the case of Rwanda, you would go back to earlier colonial policies and the creation of sort of artificial creation of ethnicities to rule by pitting one person against another. The more recent causal issues in Rwanda are that the U.S. had actually helped to train and arm Ugandan armies, which then intervened and had terrorized the people who became the perpetrators of the violence. So this did not happen in a vacuum. These are not ancient hatreds. And that even as the violence began, the European banks, France, and the IMF are all continuing policies, austerity policies that are, you know, just causing enormous suffering, starvation among people. So all sorts of things are leading into creating this horrendous crisis. Yet Clinton and others said, these are ancient hatreds. This is horrible. We can't do anything about it. And then later coming to a profound regret and saying overtly, you know, we could have saved millions of lives. We just didn't realize it. Now, just a very quick point on Bosnia. So again, historians have really tracked, you've got anytime there's a crisis like this, you've got people going back and both inventing but pulling on real historical grievances that go back to World War II. So they're there, but Yugoslavia had been a quite prosperous, peaceful country for a long time. So some of the more immediate causes that the West was involved with was weaponizing global financial instruments like the IMF World Bank in the 80s to try to weaken the Yugoslav economy. And then most immediately really squeezing the country on debt. So the federated government could no longer send money to different locales because they're funneling them to European banks. So they're getting really, again, squeezed economically at the same time that, you know, politicians are taking advantage of this incredible economic crisis, you know, to kind of stoke ethno-nationalisms. So again, I think, obviously, I mean, I could recommend these readings, and I unpack this a lot more in the book. But I think that my fundamental point here is that there are both longer term, but very immediate political consequences, I mean, political causes. And the whole clash of civilizations just said, just as Bernard Lewis said so, I think, crudely in the Roots of Muslim Rage article, that there are no political causes. There are no policy reasons. This is just irrational hatreds going back, you know, hundreds and thousands of years. This is outside of history and civilization. This is the clash of civilizations.
That's really fascinating, sort of showing how that whole frame affects the entire structure of what comes next. Let's talk a little bit about chapter 3, titled Losing the Good Life, Post-Cold War Malaise and the Enemy Within. So malaise, of course, has a funny history in recent American political history, usually traced to Jimmy Carter's speech, even though I don't believe he actually uses the word malaise in the speech, but famously known as the malaise speech. So why did you use that word, and what's going on in the U.S. in the post-Cold War period, and sort of this loss of a sense of mission that had defined, you know, the previous four decades?
Yes, thank you. Well, again, it's sort of, I think it really cuts against this myth of the end of ideology that this was such a happy time when you actually go back and look at the evidence, because what you see is, you know, as the Soviet Union is pursuing reforms, and even as, you know, that the Eastern Bloc starts to unravel, what you have in the United States is crumbling infrastructure, a deep economic crisis. We can think of this; these are all the reasons that George H.W. Bush did not win the election, you know, in 92, and Clinton got elected. And so you've got this sense of, I mean, this that partly allowed for, again, these critiques. People said, "Oh, like this, we're an economic mess. Our cities are a mess, and it's allowed for hope for the peace dividend. If the Cold War's over, maybe we can actually fix this stuff." And there was also a sense, I kind of use this as a, you know, it, and people like talk about this even in a very personal sense or a sense of political identity. People had defined the United States in relationship to its supposed superiority to the Soviet Union for so long. So if we don't have this enemy, who are we, and how do we organize our lives, and how do we even, you know, see ourselves? And for me, it was important to put that in something of a dialogue and sort of a juxtaposition with the crises going on in the Soviet Union, because as I say, at one point, you know, in this moment, sort of Russians got shock therapy and Americans got credit cards, but it was a very unsettling moment in the global political economy. And we know now that was the beginning of a burst of enormous growth in inequality, where there were massive winners and losers. But I think the malaise speaks to the real uncertainty about what was coming. And I think one of the things that happened from that was, and again, it you know, when I went back to this, and I say back to this because I did kind of live as a conscious political person through some of this, but I really examining things that I, you know, that it kind of, you know, sort of a new and sort of in a fresh way. But one of the interesting things is that this is a moment then without the Soviet enemy. Some people overtly saying, well, you know, we had to show that we were superior. We had to, you know, show that we were better than the Soviets. And so, you know, but now that the Soviet Union's gone, why should we care about racism? Why do we care about equality at all? We really don't have to. And I think in the 92 campaign that Bush lost, you really see both Bush and then sort of infamously Dan Quayle, really fascinating on crime, on poverty, and really kind of really, really blaming the victim. Just as we might say, there's a parallel that people are looking at violence globally that's a product of a combination of colonial and Cold War violence and blame, you know, sort of pinning the blame on the victim. You get these big campaigns that, you know, poverty is a choice. It's individual responsibility. And so, and it's all about the individual. And then when you look at the Republican platform in 92 and then what Gingrich and the House picks up, it's very much an attack on society. And it's a rabid attack on social programs. And you get this really bizarre language on the intellectual level. Sort of Irving Kristol is saying, global communism has been defeated, but my Cold War is just beginning. I'm going after the bureaucrats. I'm going after the social programs in the United States. We have a Kremlin mentality within our government. They accuse Bill Clinton's healthcare of being, you know, this is a socialist plan. You know, so you're getting, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you're getting this weird hysteria about socialism. And that may all seem like, okay, they didn't win. That's all well and good. But you get those programs carried out once the Republicans are in Congress and their absolute, you know, determination to dismantle all New Deal programs and all social programs. And so that is, I think, all of this sense that, so the Republicans, again, this is a deep paradox. We won the Cold War, we were right, and there is something so, so terribly wrong with America. And it is the fault of the Democrats and healthcare and welfare programs. So that kind of ugliness really, you know, creeps in very, very early on. So without an external enemy, we really, really turn in on ourselves, especially Black people, poor people. And I think, you know, sociologists and historians have written in really, you know, profound ways about like, the consequences of the dismantling of the New Deal programs and the aid for families to dependent children. And I think that's just incredibly important. And I do see a parallel in the Soviet Union. Again, they're very, very, it's very different, but what happens to people when there's no social safety nets. And I think especially for women and children, people are made dependent on the most conservative institutions. And the U.S., and especially under George W. Bush, ties those programs very overtly, puts them in churches very intentionally. But if you don't have daycare, if you don't have health care, where is your kid going to be dropped off? You know, so you get this enormous growth in both growth in church membership, in, you know, religious affiliation and church memberships. But I think, again, it makes especially poor women, you know, either very dependent on their own families, whether those families are maybe they're loving and supportive, maybe they're abusive. They're dependent on those families or they're dependent on these conservative institutions.
Where does that hatred of American society come from? Why do these people hate American society so much? Is it just ideology? Is it that simple?
So that turning in on the United States, I don't know. I do know. I think it's profoundly racialized and gendered. So I think it's, and I think some people would argue that from, you know, the very moment that school integration was achieved to some extent from Brown versus Board of Ed, as you know, of course, there was still a real struggle for integration. But as Black people entered the public schools, people said, "We're not giving any more money to those public schools." So I think it's profoundly connected to racism. It's profoundly connected to sort of misogyny that's directly, you know, directed against sort of a the idea that feminism or women's movement have, you know, ruined, you know, a certain kind of society. But I think that gets really reshuffled and reconfigured. You know, it really does get reshuffled and reconfigured in the aftermath, you know, of the Cold War. As you see these very overt you know, really overt attacks. And again, it's hard to draw a clear causal line, but at the January 6th insurrection and everything surrounding it and what happened during the pandemic, it just astounds me how a whole block of people, like, who are their targets? They're going after public school teachers. They're going after healthcare workers. So this notion of, like, the Kremlin being an authoritarianism and control being hidden in these, I think, these very, very precious institutions. You know, society is what holds us together as human beings. But I think it gets very sharply articulated by in that platform in 92, in those campaigns. And it's just very striking how sort of quickly people, again, turned in and on themselves, and I don't want to exaggerate. There was certainly conflict before that, and it doesn't, you know, but it's sort of the container of those tensions and ideas were, you know, either collapsed or were really reshuffled after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
So I think this will be a good place to end. And Penny, we look forward to having you back on a future episode. But of course, the first word in the title is paradoxes. So I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about this anti-government feeling that takes off in the 90s while there's this remilitarization, because there was contestation. You know, someone like Pat Buchanan, so-called paleoconservatism, you know, someone like Murray Rothbard, paleolibertarianism, were genuinely arguing against having this empire of bases. How do you talk about that contradiction between this anti-government feeling on the one hand, but then this pro-government, i.e. pro-military feeling on the other? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's always been a kind of a deep contradiction. And I think, I'm just kind of thinking out loud, because when I think about that in the 90s, that's the most striking thing about Reagan's ideology, right? Because Reagan is the, you know, the first person who says, we are dismantling, you know, the New Deal, get the monkey of government off people's back, when the military increased exponentially. So under Reagan, the state grew at just an exorbitant rate even. So I think that really deeply hits that kind of contradiction. And I think on a more, and again, that's radically different than somebody like Eisenhower, who at least recognized that, you know, this is a problem for democracy. We've created a military-industrial complex, and we got to really look at the consequences of this. So
he says after he creates said complex.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's very different, right? Ideologically or rhetorically than what Reagan's doing. And I think that there is, again, a part of this paradox is, and I think, you know, some people have called this, you know, paranoid empire, is this very, again, contradictory sense that we're both the, you know, only legitimate power, the most powerful power, but that we are always at risk of victimization or being invaded. So, and in this era, then you get this, you know, the idea that of clash of civilizations. So this tension between, again, claiming to be the most powerful, but always claiming to be a great threat. George W. Bush's campaign, he was really talking to those terms in such interesting ways, because he was saying, you know, and I'm going to maybe paraphrase the Bushisms, like when I was coming up, we had enemies, but we knew who they were, we knew where they were, and now we don't know, you know, and he says it was us and them, and this is a nostalgia. It's like, it was really clear. That was really good. And now we don't know who the them are. We know they're out there. We don't know who them are. And so he's really spinning out this sense of foreboding. And we know a lot of his advisors were already, like, they're trying to go back into Iraq, and they're trying to, you know, so they're kind of running with this vision of an intervention in Iraq and toppling Saddam Hussein, and that's a plan long before 9/11. But I think that gets that, and he has the sort of same sense that got articulated by Reagan and then George H.W., like, we won through military might. I will George H.W. says, I will never let this country be weak again. We're the strongest. We're going to stay strong through the military, but we're really, you know, the jungle is encroaching. We're under threat. And, you know, and some historians would locate that in a very long history of just settler colonialism, wars against Indigenous Americans, and sort of moments of an idea of a sort of white civilization against a threat that goes far back. In this book, I'm much more interested in the immediate contingencies and the, but I do think we need to take, you know, very seriously how and why does a civilizationist idea and language come up so quickly, like once again. Not that it's ever been banished, but it's certainly not dominant in either public discourse or in the popular culture of the 80s and 90s. So it's just remarkable. And I think it's, so I was just really interested in investigating how that came up again and how that comes up in multiple registers across political speech, popular culture, and so many different areas.
Penny Von Eschen, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone check out Paradoxes of Nostalgia. Penny, I don't know if you remember, but I saw you give an early talk on it at Cornell in like 2014. It was so cool then, and just to see the execution now. It's really a fantastic book that I think would be useful to anyone interested in the last 30 years of history and explaining what it feels like to live today. Please check it out, and we look forward to having you back again soon.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for your time.
We'll be right back.